Hello and welcome to the Theology Mill podcast brought to you by Wipfenstock Publishers. My name is Zach Mickle. I am the digital marketing manager here at Wipfenstock, and I am the host of this podcast, which consists of interviews with leading authors and thinkers in theology, biblical studies, and philosophy. You're listening to the third episode in our Christian Universalism booth. The booth features a series of interviews on Christian Universalism, coming at the topic from several different angles. So we have interviewees who are ranging widely in their approaches. So in our first episode, we learned about evangelical universalism from Robin Perry. And then from there, we followed up with an episode on existential universalism with David Congdon. And then in this, our final episode, we will talk about Catholic universalism with Jordan Daniel Wood. And in addition to these interviews, you can also find on our blog, the Wipfenstock blog, a virtual exhibit that we put together for the booth. And that exhibit includes a large handful of our books on the topic, as well as a 40% discount on all volumes included in the exhibit. And there is an expiration date in early May on that discount, so be sure and get in there by then if you want to get the 40% discount. The link to that exhibit is below in the show notes. On this third episode, I interviewed Dr. Jordan Daniel Wood. As I said already, Jordan earned his PhD in historical theology from Boston College in 2019 and published a book with the University of Notre Dame Press, The Whole Mystery of Christ, Creation as Incarnation in Maximus Confessor. He was also just recently appointed as assistant professor of theology at Belmont University to begin in August 2024, but he spent the past 3 years as a stay-at-home dad of four. And then another quick note that I want to mention at the beginning of all of these episodes is that if you would like more Universalism content, we do have a two-part series on Christian Universalism with David Artman. So those two episodes are from July 2023. So if you'd like to give them a listen, you can just scroll down our list of episodes and find them there, or you can find them in the show notes below. David provides a really nice overview of Universalism there. So I think it's a really nice starting point for people who are just curious about the topic or who want maybe kind of a broader treatment of it. And with that, without any further ado, let's jump over to the episode. Thank you so much for listening to the Theology Mill. Okay, so I am here with Jordan Daniel Wood, who is coming on for the third time onto our podcast, which we're very blessed and grateful to have him agreeing to come on again. And this time it's going to be for our third episode in our Universalism booth. So he's kind of representing a kind of a Catholic Universalist position. And so, you know, a lot of our listeners probably already know who you are, know a bit about you. But for those who don't, or maybe who could learn more, could you maybe just share, Jordan, a bit about yourself as we get started?
Yeah, sure. I mean, most of my work and formation has been in patristic or broadly pre-modern Christian theology. So patristic mainly, but also some medieval. And so that could explain a little bit of my proclivities, because my entree into the early Christian tradition was the Alexandrian tradition, specifically through Clement Origen of Alexandria. My wife was raised Catholic, but I've been a Catholic for almost a decade now. And yeah, for the last 3 years, I've been a stay-at-home dad, been doing side projects, and then just recently got a position that I'll be moving into this fall. So doing patristics, Maximus the Confessor is kind of my main guy, but really broadly interested in, you know, a lot of different things, idealism, a lot of stuff. So
awesome. Yeah, I know we already talked pre-show about it, but congratulations again on the tenure track job. It's very good news. Perhaps your answer will be different this time, so I'm going to ask it again with our kind of our Theology Mill opener, and maybe in light of the Universalism conversation, I don't know, your answer will be a little different. But so our opener question, if you could place any three thinkers, dead or alive, together in a room and you could listen to their conversation, which three thinkers would you choose and why?
So let's do it in light of the universalism conversation, because that way, yeah, I got a little focus and it will change it up from last time. At least I think it will. I don't actually remember what I said last time. So if it's the universalism question, of course, the two that I want two right away that I want to put in the room are Origen and Augustine. I want to see them like talk about Romans 9 through 11. I want to see them talk about predestination and so forth. And then if I had a third to the mix, who would it be? I would probably choose, just to spice it up a little, although some people might not think this particularly spicy, I'd probably throw in like Karl Rahner.
Okay.
So just because Rahner himself is interesting on the question of universalism, like a lot of thinkers in the mid 20th century, it seems like there was definitely a reticence to claim something like a label like universalism. I know you've talked about with some of your other guests, like say Barthes, for example, Karl Barthes won't say he's a universalist and there's all this stuff, but yeah, Rahner has a little bit of that. And even in some of his late interviews, like the few years before he died in the 80s, he seems way more open to it than in certain spots he had before. So anyway, but then he would bring, I think, some of the specifically modern questions and perspectives to the discussion that Augustine and Origen would have in a more sort of, might say, classical register. And so I would want to see what old Uncle Carl, as some of us call him, I would want to see what Uncle Carl, what kind of questions he would pose to those other two. So that would be for the universalism question, of course. So it's if you give me a different topic, it'd be totally different.
Yeah. People. Yeah. I was trying to call back what you said last time. And I think the last time you were on was for the Bulgakov booth. And if I'm remembering correctly, I think you said Bulgakov. I want to say you said Bulgakov, Balthazar, and Augustine. But I might
have been.
That might have been someone else who said that. But anyways, if that's the case, certainly we have a different cast of characters, but Augustine's still in there. So yeah. Oh, very good.
I think okay. I think it's easy to pick Augustine, right? Because he's sort of like he's the guy for so many. So yeah, you're kind of covering a lot of bits, like, you know, you got the Reformed, but anyway, so you got the Catholics, you got the Reformed. But anyway, yeah. So
yeah, yeah. No, and yeah, so influential on the Latin Rite tradition for sure. Okay, something I asked at least David Congdon on our prior universalism episode that I'd like to ask you as well is how did you originally kind of come around to the view of Christian universalism? But then also maybe, you know, has your view of what that entails changed in any way since you kind of first came around to that view?
Let's see. I don't have a a lightning bolt moment or something where it just sort of clicked, or at least I don't recall one. I definitely was. So unlike David, I heard his interview. And so unlike David Congdon, who sort of said that he more or less always intuited, or what David Hart says in his book on the subject.
Yeah.
I was raised in a context where eternal conscious torment was definitely the only option. I don't even really recall hearing annihilationism as a possibility until I got to the small Bible college I went to. And that was only because John Stott held it, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think Robin Perry mentioned him, right, for example, he was a major figure, you know. Definitely his writings were assigned to us. But then when you find out, no one ever taught about his annihilationism, but when you find out he is, and maybe like J.T. Robinson's views on eschatology or something, and, you know, you're using his harmony of the gospels, but then you find out he has this view about eschatology that's not ETC or ECT. But so I was raised in that. Now I almost want to call it normie hell because it was like, there are some places, and I know, and I had some friends that hell and the prospect of hell was like very explicitly front and center all the time.
Yeah.
Like to almost like a pathological, like a psychological terror sort of level. I don't think that was the case. That was not the case for me yet. I also, what's interesting is that even though it wasn't like, you know, you were getting fire and brimstone every sermon, or you were getting there were like altar calls all the time. Mm-hmm. There were definitely what I would want to say is hell cast its shadow over everything, but it really was shadowy in the sense that it wasn't something that was talked about or even preached about directly. Like that's the topic or whatever. It was framed in more generic terms like judgment or whatever. But in a way though, you can retrospectively, you can look back and kind of be like, I mean, but still everything, that was the engine for everything. Mm-hmm. All the emphasis on evangelism, all the emphasis on missions, the way it was presented, you know, the biographies in the Bible College where you would read people like David Livingstone or whatever, traveling to the heart of Africa to try to, you know, save souls from hell. You know, that's so very much was the logic of the gospel but it was just interesting because the way it was packaged was much more like, you know, milk toast or sort of like hell light. So I don't know what to say about that. But anyway, I didn't really have any reason to question it. And in fact, I think I've said this somewhere, but I still have this essay I wrote when I was probably 20 years old called Why Hell is Fuller Than Heaven. And it was in response to, interestingly, there was a friend of mine who was training to be a missionary. He was on the same dorm floor that I was on. And he had already started thinking about like, I don't know about, but you know, usually it was packaged in the term like the sort of classic, like, well, what about the person who's never heard, blah, blah, blah. Are they going end up in hell? So he had asked me specifically why I thought, you know, or what I thought about it. And so I write this essay. So I was it was very much the opposite of what I believe now, but I like to keep it there just to kind of remind myself of where I was and mm-hmm. where I came from and not to be a little too haughty about what I think I've now discovered. But so I do think though that throughout the rest of, I became more broadly interested and troubled or unsettled in a good way about the fact that the tradition I was raised in was more or less severed from the Christian, like broad Christian history, you might want to say, just the actual history of Christianity in the churches. Yeah. And so once I started studying that, I had two questions that were related, and I think retrospectively I can see they were leading me towards a universalist position more broadly. One question was how to read scripture, and specifically in light of number two, the second question, divine violence in scripture. I was like a budding pacifist at the time, and I was reading, like, you know, secretly outside of the assigned courses. I was reading like Stan Hauerwas and, you know, like before all the unfortunate revelations came out, I was reading like Yoder or whatever.
So, yeah.
Miroslav Volf and some of those guys. So mm-hmm. so we had like little reading groups, felt like it was some kind of, you know, I don't know, some sort of underground
seminar.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. From the very intensely persecuted culture of Joplin, Missouri, on Route 66. So, but anyway, we imagine ourselves, you know, as sort of avant-garde, but nevertheless, that really was a pressing, I think what became for me, the hermeneutical issue. And this, I do think, is a through line all the way to current, even now, discussions about universalism. The question for me, like the broader the deeper question for me and all that was always, how is it that this God revealed in Jesus Christ, who, you know, in the words of Romans 5, while we were enemies and hostile to God, yet died for us. How is it that that's the same one, the same God who in, you know, the Old Testament commands genocide 5 times or so? And I just really, so it became a very multifaceted line of questioning. And so simultaneously, I'm hearing about this figurative and allegorical reading that was more popular once upon a time in Christian tradition. And then I hear about this guy named Origen. So anyway, I start studying those questions in tandem, reading scripture theologically versus the literal historical critical. And that is actually all, they would put all those together. The way that I was being taught. And then specifically in the connection with divine violence and the revelation of God's character as love, all that stuff was swirling. So I hadn't really gotten to eschatology, and I more or less bracketed that out from my mind until probably my mid-20s. But I don't know what it was then in the mid-20s. I don't know. I think I just thought about it more. I became a father and started reading more broadly. Probably the closest thing to a major revelatory moment was reading George MacDonald's novel Lilith. Was because the picture that you get there is not only one of profound judgment, which was striking and in some ways terrifying, but also unbelievable and far deeper hope. And it was just so compelling as a vision that it made me revisit and more deeply think through all that stuff. So I don't know. It's the best I got in terms of where the trajectory that led me to it. Since becoming convinced of that perspective, what has changed? I don't know if a lot has fundamentally changed, except that I am Catholic. Mm-hmm. And so being Catholic, I do find it, you know, it's part of what it means to be Catholic, to be deferent to the magisterium. I am not one of what you might call a magisterial fundamentalist, though. Mm-hmm. I have come from the background of fundamentalism, and sometimes I wonder whether or not Catholics realize the dangers that lie there, and they've just made a new form of fundamentalism, especially in America.
Yeah.
It turns out that the magisterium, which is, yes, called, and it calls itself the sole interpreter of scripture and tradition, also has to be interpreted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as I like to say, some more conservatives have rediscovered that truth during Francis's pontificate. And I think that's for the better, actually, you know, because I'm not a partisan of popes in this sort of like right or left sort of way. That's not really a Catholic way to think about the papacy.
Yeah.
So anyway, but nevertheless, I don't think you can. I also think you just can't just shirk it, or you can. It's just not persuasive, though, to shirk the magisterial tradition. And there's no question that universalism, as I hold it, is not the like objective teaching of official teaching of the Catholic Church today. It isn't. It would be a lie to say otherwise.
Yeah.
But just because it isn't doesn't mean it's not true either. I think it would equally be a lie to say that just because something is not currently explicitly taught, and maybe even things are taught that seemed a priori or prima facie to oppose it. Well, there have been instances of that as well, where what you really need is a fuller picture of the truth rather than a simple reversal, although there have been those as well in the actual history. So anyway, that goes off into a discussion of, development of Catholic, topics par excellence, you know, which is development of doctrine, revelation of God and history, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think the way my universalism has changed, just to be very specific, is, for example, I have felt incumbent to think through, for example, the distinction between purgatory and hell, which if you're a quote unquote patristic universalist, or if you're a like an Eastern Orthodox universalist of some kind, if you're Bulgakov or whatever, even though I think he's a little more complicated, but you can just say, look, hell is purgatorial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the hellfire simply does purge. And so there's really no point making a further distinction between, say, a condition called purgatory and one. So I've had to incorporate that and think. So if anything, I just think my universalism, because I've been Catholic, has had to become more creative, and I actually think more interesting and rich, and actually more able to synthesize and incorporate what seem to be varying and maybe even opposed stretch in both strands in both scripture and tradition into a more coherent synthesis or whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, you said that universalism is not the objective teaching of the Catholic Church, but maybe for our listeners, has the Catholic Church kind of rejected that as a position, or is it just that it doesn't hold it forth as a positive option?
So, I mean, I think that depends on who you talk to, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, some people, but at the same time, what I would say is that hopeful universalism is an objective teaching of the even of the official magisterium right now. I make a point to actually, you could go to the catechism right now and talk about, and it'll talk about how we are to have hope for the salvation of all. And then they'll cite the prayers from the liturgy or the hours, just as von Balthasar did in 1986. It basically has taken, in my opinion, the current magisterium of the Catholic Church is, their view is Balthasar's. You can look at St. John Paul II and his papal, I think it was it wasn't an encyclical, but I think it was like pastoral letter or whatever it was, Missio Redemptoris. And he explicitly says that the real possibility of salvation of all is something you have to hold. And then the second thing you have to hold is that it happens through incorporation to the body of Christ, to the church. But of course, church there is post-Vatican II. It's the church which subsists in the Roman Catholic or in the Catholic Church, but isn't necessarily confined to it.
Right.
And so, I actually think what I would say is that hopeful universalism, as distinguished from a quote unquote dogmatic universalism, is the current view of the Catholic Church, number one. And then number two, I would say it definitely was not always that.
Yeah.
I think that is a development. I don't even know if that's really disputable, but it's funny because if you read someone like Ralph Martin, this very sort of anti-Balthasarian thinker, and I've seen a lot of Catholic apologists, mostly online ones, who will say that even hopeful universalism is illicit and not the objective, and the church opposes that. I mean, I don't know how, I guess you just have to be anti-Vatican II or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't understand how you square that. But so no, it is not. So I do hold to a more, I don't know, there's all these people, all these labels now starting to float around, so I don't know what I believe. Here's what I believe. God wills the salvation of all. That's also in the catechism. The way they read that verse from 1 Timothy and Peter isn't the way, say, Augustine did. They actually do say, no, that it's not all there doesn't mean all the elect.
Right.
That's a move that would be more common in the classical sort of earlier tradition. But no, the catechism teaches that no, it's an absolute all. It's God actually wants the salvation of everything he creates. Okay, so I think that, and I think God will accomplish that. It's almost that simple to me. It's like on the level of like God wants to, God has the means to, because he's sufficient, all sufficient. I mean, he's all wise, he's all powerful. And he's all loving, and he knows how to get to us, each of us, in our own hearts and souls, even like the reasons of the heart that Pascal talked about. Not that Pascal was a universalist or anything, but God can get to even those. Like it's not, it's a different depth of reason, but it's not therefore irrational. Mm-hmm. And so God can get to those, even if the way he does so are the reasons that will fundamentally fuel the conversion of all souls, spoken of, I think, in Philippians 2. They won't be able to be simply abstracted into a formula, a crystallized formula that is ahistorical, precisely because salvation isn't ahistorical. It's the salvation of everyone and every creature in history, and all the way down to the particularities of that creature. None of that's abstractable into a nice, neat syllogism, in my opinion. So I believe that. Now, does the objective teaching right now of the Catholic Church oppose that? Well, I don't think so. I mean, otherwise I would have a lot harder go at it, right? But that doesn't. So two things can be true at once. My position is not currently the objective official teaching of the Catholic Church. And also the specific way that I want to be a universalist as a Catholic needs to take into account what seems to be right now certain elements or points of the teaching that even contradict or oppose that. Like I have to take that into account. I have to incorporate that in my own perspective. And that's what it partly means to be a Catholic theologian. So that's I don't remember exactly if that addresses the question you asked, but
it does. I think it does. Yeah. No, I think it does very well. Yeah, you were generous enough to send me several kind of online video interviews you've done on universalism. And you mentioned, right, that you actually haven't written that much about it. It's been more kind of online interviews, but quite a few of those. And so one of those interviews, you said that Catholicism is sufficiently deep, wide, and rich, and that universalism is equally deep, wide, and rich. So I'm interested, maybe in what ways do you see Catholics today and you've touched on this a bit maybe already, but kind of them conceiving of their Catholicism as something that we might think of as kind of less than deep, white, and rich, especially like on the American scene, I'm thinking in particular.
Yeah.
You know, something kind of a form of Catholicism that we might even describe as kind of narrow or a dynamic in ways that would kind of close down a universalist option. Like you were mentioning, you know, some people who are that way. So
yeah.
Is it the case that those people maybe just haven't understood kind of the breadth and dynamism of the tradition sufficiently, or what do you think is going on there?
So I think there's two things going on. And it's interesting. So I think it was Congar, some very well-known thinker said of Vatican II, that the issue below the issues was development of doctrine. And so I think the same dynamic plays out in discussions among Catholics, especially like you said in America, around the question of universalism, because on the one hand, there's the actual question, right? Like, you could get into the weeds about divine predestination. And actually, I think there's a very interesting way a colleague and I, but I should say this, a colleague and I, have already begun very extensively planning and outlining a book together that will be called probably a Catholic Universalism. And so we do want to write. So I do want to write on it, but it is funny so far. I haven't written much on it. It's just more been like conversations, but, and one of the things we will talk about in there a little bit is that there are immediate, you can get into the weeds immediately of like say the De Auxilis controversy, which is about human freedom and divine grace and predestination, all this stuff, which was so restive, so recalcitrant in resolution that the Pope had to step in and basically say, look, I'm not giving any resolution to this theological problem about how it is that divine predestination relates to human freedom in the conversion, the salvation of human beings. But you can't anathematize each other, right? So, but I think in some ways, the Catholic discussion of universalism is going to have to return to some of those fundamental controversies. So it's just to say that you can get into the actual theological, say systematic, or you might even say philosophical, theological weeds around the issue itself. But the group that you're invoking and that I was alluding to earlier, there's also the issue below the issue. Which is much more about this development question. And I think that is it's bidirectional. There's two different orientations at once there. So to answer the question directly, yes, sometimes I just think they don't know the tradition that they so champion and defend as well as their degree of confidence would suggest. So let's give a very clear example, and I'm sorry if this is co-opting something you were going to ask later, but you know, how many times have we heard, look, Constantinople II, 553, condemned universalism. It's done, man. Like the tradition's already judged it. It's over. How could you be, you know, so you're a heretic or something if you hold this view. Okay, let's get into some specifics, right? And I'm not going to do this very long, but it's an example. First of all, I always like to say this, and people think it's cheeky, but it really isn't. It's making a point. Where is the word universalism in that council? Oh, well, it's not there. Okay, all right. Now, they might say, yeah, but look at the canons. Okay, but my first point about that is just that you're using the word universalism and saying that's been condemned. The word itself doesn't even show up in the whole conciliar tradition. So then the question becomes, and this is the real point, the church doesn't condemn abstract things, at least very often, because if it does, then anyone can simply just say, well, I don't hold that. So what it does end up condemning is very specific visions or proposals or teachings or whatever, right? And lo and behold, let's skip over all the very contested historical arguments that have gone on about whether or not the canons are actually proper to that council. Let's just assume they are. Let's give it the best case. Well, there's two things to note about that. In 543, the emperor Justinian had his own list of canons and condemnations, one of which was, I think it was number 9, was that the pains of hell were temporary. Well, interesting, in the canons that were later attributed to Constantinople II, that canon doesn't appear. It's gone. Okay, so that's interesting. That's an anecdotal thing. It's a circumstantial point. Then you say, okay, but let's look at the actual canons, number 1 and number 14. One says, speaks about the apokatastasis, the monstrous restoration of all things, quote, which follows from the preexistence of souls. If you skip to 14, what does that look like? It looks like the absorption and destruction of, quote, names, numbers, hypostases, individuals. So the restoration in view there, which is condemned, is one that entails the obliteration of the identity of those that are supposedly reunited with God, according to this primordial henad, where they were also indistinct and just sort of, as it were, one henad without any sort of identity, essentially. Okay, great. I don't teach any of that. So like, right. So the point would be that's the point is, like, even if I were to grant that those are totally and completely and unambiguous canons that condemn something, it's not something called universalism because the word isn't even there. It is something very specific called a monstrous apokatastasis, which follows from a certain protological view of a primordial henad. Guess what? I'm not doing any of that. So what are you talking about when you appeal to that council, right? Yeah. So there's this kind of facile, glib, blithe appeal to, well, you know, universalism has been condemned once upon a time in 553, but then you realize pretty quickly they don't even really know the details usually. So that's one problem, is they don't really know the tradition that they're defending and they're championing and fancy themselves sort of guardians of as well as they think. So that's a past oriented issue.
Yeah.
But then I do think there's a future oriented. This is the other orientation. The other orientation is that, and I will say this kind of as boldly as I can, I don't think it's even permissible to be a Catholic today and deny radical development of doctrine in principle. You're a post Vatican II Christian or Catholic. You are committed in principle. That means in the very, at least in possibility, even if you disagree about where this applies, you are committed in principle, not just to the possibility that radical developments or some developments in doctrine will come. Actually, I think according to like De Verbum 8, you're committed to it positively happening. It will occur. This is because what's revealed is not some new information that helps you like get a better grasp of the world in some sort of empirical or even abstract way. But what's revealed is God himself, who's infinite. And so any kind of presumption to, in principle, confine what the depths of God's self-revelation in and through history and through his body, the church, any in principle opposition to a deepening, which is recommended not only in Vatican II, but also in like Fides et Ratio and a lot of other places, is not Catholic. You're no longer talking about God's own self-revelation. You're talking about your version of Catholicism, which you've essentialized and which you've made absolute. And I think that's a false deification, and it's actually its own false presumption and arrogance. So I think the Catholic view has to remain open in both directions. And the funny thing is, this is the very thing we say about Scripture. I mean, yeah. It's inspired. Can you fathom its depths? And this is part, see, my entry into the Christian tradition was one of the first lessons I learned, and I was blown away by, is that the way that they preserve the canon of Scripture as inspired is exactly not by being a literalist or a fundamentalist about it.
Yeah.
You preserve the inspiration of Scripture and therefore the canon, which is the thing people fixate on that. Oh, it's the canon. It's the canon. It's the canon. It's the measure. It's the, you know, it's the formula. It's the finite thing. It's the thing we can't question, whatever. No. But the only way you can preserve the actual limits is precisely if you don't put limits to what it can mean.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean it can mean anything, but it also doesn't mean that what it can mean is limited. Those are different. So what I want to say is, whether we're looking to the past in terms of the revelation of the testimony, the revelation and the testimony to the incarnate word through scriptures or through the tradition, because the incarnate word is himself eternal. He's the second person of the Trinity. And he's the synthesis of God and creation. He is creator and creature. That person, he is the synthesis. There's no like abstract synthesis. So that is unfathomable. So you can't put a limit on what even past revelatory media can mean, even though I still agree it can't mean, it just doesn't mean, it can't just mean anything, but you can't in principle put a limit on what it can mean, or else it's no longer God who's being revealed. It's something else. And similarly, that's the very same dynamism which, as a Catholic, I believe propels the church towards development in the future. And this is the broader theology. So that's the way I would start to, there's much more that can be said, but that's the way I would start to address the issue below the issue.
Yeah.
And when a lot of people in the American scene sort of flip out about this stuff, I think it's mostly that they're reacting to that issue below the issue. And I think that's like, it's just the sort of same, in some ways it's so banal, it's almost kind of boring to rehearse, but it's like, yeah, you're afraid that the church that, and let's be honest, a lot of them are converts from other traditions, not all of them, but a lot of them are.
Yeah.
The church that you like, whose ship you boarded because you were so scared of the chaotic seas of modernity and of maybe what you perceive as the collapse of Western civilization, and that you now see as you see this church as the last bastion that's unmovable and that can resist the tides of chaotic nihilism or whatever, just to get poetic, really. Now it's like, but what if you enter this church and you see that even it can change? The whole point was that the immutable truth, the eternal truth, shouldn't be able to change, and that's why you came here. And then what do you do? Well, you turn into Taylor Marshall. Not all of them do, but you know, it's a trajectory though, and it's kind of coherent. Right. In its own way. Right.
Yeah, no, I do think you're pinpointing something important, and that's very much a phenomenon, at least in my experience, on especially on the American scene in the Catholic Church, of like this kind of convert theology that's kind of overzealous. And I mean, we both are converts, and I feel like even some of my reasons for conversion, I look back and I'm like, yeah, that's those were not the best reasons for me to convert to the Catholic Church. But I do think there's a lot of like, yeah, people getting maybe tired of the fragmentation of their Protestant upbringing or whatever, and looking for something, you know, much more solid to stand on. And that's not all bad, but just, yeah, kind of losing or kind of never really having a sense of the dynamism that's at work in the Catholic tradition, and that it's not just this monolith that's preserved unscathed and unchanged through history. Two thinkers that you've engaged pretty substantially, and that you've brought up both of them already in our conversation, are Hans Urs von Balthasar and George MacDonald. So and both of them obviously write about universalism. So I'm wondering if you could maybe, I know this is a big question, especially for a podcast, but if you could maybe kind of briefly lay out what their positions are on universalism, and then maybe if you kind of lean more towards one or the other as far as your own views on universalism.
So I think those two map on pretty well, as like they're pretty much representatives of two, again, species of Christian universalism. And again, the labels circulating today vary, and they're being created sort of all the time, it seems. But you might say that whereas Balthasar is what's called a hopeful universalist, George MacDonald is a dogmatic or a universalist. Now, another circulating, you know, pair is soft universalism, which would be Balthasar, or hard universalism, which would be someone like MacDonald. I'm myself sort of skeptical of those labels. Usually they're wielded by people that are more or less just polemicists or apologists, and they don't really distinguish between, they don't really say much, honestly. But nevertheless, let's go with it for now. So Balthasar's view, I have to say, because like, so this is already an example of the problem with the label. So for example, I can think of some fairly well or well known in the Anglophone or the American scene figures who will just lash out against hard universalism, and they think it's like a heresy, and they'll even go to like pretty extreme, really absurd lengths of like, basically every heresy you've ever heard of, it's somehow attached to this. And so, you know, it's Pelagianism, but also at the same time, somehow it's Calvinism, but at the same time, it's also undermines the cross of Christ or whatever, you know, whatever bad thing you can think of, it's probably there. What's interesting, though, is these same people would claim to be a soft universalist, which is just to say that I think they adhere to what we talked about earlier was already the pretty more or less uncontroversial teaching of the current magisterium, which is that the real possibility of salvation of all. But they themselves are usually pretty pessimistic about whether or not that'll actually happen. Balthazar isn't. And so that's something I do want to give. I want to be fair to Balthazar. Even when I compare, like I like to compare and contrast him to George MacDonald. I've done that before, but I do think that, you know, reading a fuller, more fair reading of Balthazar should highlight that Balthazar sees the scales tipping towards the hope as it's spoken of in Romans 5, which says hope does not disappoint. So what's troubling about Balthazar is that he seems to oscillate, though, in his language about this hope. So number one, Balthazar's position is we should, it's stated clearly, it's we should hope for the salvation of all. Hmm. Now, and I say should, that's a kind of almost like it's a subjunctive sort of thing, but it's much more like an ought. We really ought to, and that ought already carries something like a degree of confidence that God, I mean, Balthazar says it, if God wants to, he can.
Yeah.
He will do it. And Balthazar has, for example, this other argument where he traces, according to him, there's a very distinct shift from Old to New Testament, from just a clear justice sort of system where God's justice will reign, all the way to a tip towards hope and mercy. And he specifically says that's because, as is clear in the New Testament, the judge to come is he who is the lamb who is slaughtered. So the merciful judge is merciful precisely because he's also sort of the sacrifice, or he's also the one who has been slain, you know, in terms of Revelation, Apocalypse. And so his inclination is going to be decidedly tipped towards mercy and hope, because that's the whole, like, that's the reason he came. And so so Balthazar's position is that we should hope for the salvation of all, and the should really is like an ought. We should have a kind of confidence that God can and wants that, and so that gives us vitality for our prayers, which we as Catholics are called to pray for the salvation of the whole world in liturgy, in the Mass, in certain parts of the hours, in the Divine Mercy Chaplet, wherever you want to go, it's you're praying for that. And so what you pray for, it can't be that it's fundamentally like false or like contra some people. It can't be a heresy. Why would God have us? Why would the church have us pray for something that, if it's true, is a heresy? So the fact that we're praying for this means that we should hope for it, and our hope should have a kind of confidence. Nevertheless, the other part, the other qualifier for Balthazar, what distinguishes him from someone like MacDonald, is that you can't know. You can't claim a certainty to the resolution to come. You can't say, you can't make hope into knowledge. He says at one point, and this is the part where hope starts to lose some of its, I think, vitality. And this is a tension, in my opinion, in his view, where he says, I hope my sick friend will be healed tomorrow, but do I therefore know he will be? Implication, no. So you can hope. There he's appealing to something like a common sense notion of hope. Like, well, I hope that works out for you or whatever. I mean, even if you really hope, like your heart's in it, I really, really hope, you know, my friend is healed. That doesn't mean you know what will happen. And then he'll also make moves to appeal to, for example, a famous one people always cite is where he says, you know, we cannot peek at the cards that the judge holds. We can't look at the judge's hand, you know? And so there's this kind of appeal. So there's this mixture of appeal to, you know, after all, God is the judge. So you can't really know what he's going to judge. Also, we can't really confuse hope with certainty. There's a kind of anti-system thrust in Balthazar, which he's had long before, but he brings to bear here. There's a kind of concern for an existential gravitas to the spiritual life that says, you know, well, if you're just going to go around and tell people, it's all going to, you know. So there's a kind of, right, and in that way, that's why his view has been so, I think, accepted and maybe even become more or less the official view. Is because it seems to kind of do justice to, especially I think, which is the concern all the way since Trent on, Council of Trent on, is it's a concern that nobody gets lax in their spiritual endeavors and their spiritual life, right? Yeah. And so anything that seems to threaten that is resisted. Like even in 1992, the current problems in eschatology, it's the CDF, where Ratzinger was the head of the CDF at the time. It says, worries in there, it says salvation can never be understood as a quote quasi-automatic consequence or result. So this sense of like, oh, I'm going to presume, you know, that I know God, he like almost owes me salvation. Okay. So that's Balthazar. We should hope for the salvation of all, but we can't therefore claim to know if it will in fact occur. There's tensions there, but I think that's his view more or less. Mm-hmm. And it is genuinely hopeful. I don't want to pretend like, I think his little rhetorical move there about, I can't hope there. Do I therefore know? It's a little bit obfuscating because he is a little more confident than that sounds.
Yeah.
MacDonald is very confident. he thinks he so ties the ultimate result of God's own work. I mean, I do have to say we have to keep that in mind. Like salvation is something that God wants.
Yeah.
It's something that he absolutely wills. It's something that it's like the reason that anything exists at all, because salvation, in my opinion, isn't, and actually MacDonald is explicit about this as well. Salvation isn't like some other thing God does. It's God finishing his work of creating.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it has the, it's finishing the work that has been fallen for sure. And so we can speak of salvation, but preserving through duress or through onslaught or corruption, spoilation. But nevertheless, the result isn't something, it's not like the salvation's result is something other than creation's. The goal is the same. And so God has undertaken this project. And so for MacDonald, whether or not God knows how and can and in fact will bring about the completion of the project he started says everything about who God is. So for him, the kind of confidence or even certainty, he'll even use that language, that he has that God will in fact bring all to union with himself, to salvation, is precisely the certainty of faith spoken of in Hebrews 11. Like faith isn't just it's not like the colloquial, I just sort of trust. I don't really know, though, which would lend itself to the more colloquial, well, I hope it happens, but I don't know. No, it's theological faith. It's certainty. It's certainty that, yes, isn't like the certainty you might have in the when you apprehend 2 + 2 = 4. But that's not because it's less certain. It's because it's certain to a totally different degree. And I would add probably it's the certainty is more like a relational or what even Schelling would call a moral certainty, a moral necessity. It's not mechanistic. It's not God has to bring about the salvation in the same way that when you solve for X in algebra, you need to bring out the proper quantity to give a proper logical coherent resolution to the algebraic expression. It is much more like, I know my father wouldn't kill somebody for $5. And it's not because he's incapable, like technically speaking. It's not like he doesn't have arms or something where he can't do that, or he doesn't have his wits about him anymore or something. No, it's because I know who he is. I know his character. And so my first conclusion, if like someone showed me a video of my dad doing that and it was clearly authentic, my first conclusion wouldn't be, wow, I guess my dad did do that. It would be, my dad lost his mind.
Yeah.
Like he's not himself. He's not himself. So anyway, that's the kind of, I think that's more the flavor of MacDonald's certainty in the absolute restoration of all, that God will bring it about because don't you know God? Don't you know he's a father? Don't you know he loves his children? Don't you know he's the shepherd who goes and finds the last sheep and leaves the 99 to go find the one? Don't you know that he would come down and become one of us and go to hell, be crucified and go down to hell and into death in order to bring the spoils of death to salvation? Like, that's who he is. And so surely that God wouldn't start something he can't finish. If it meant the eternal conscious torment and suffering and turmoil, however you depict that, of even one of his children. So that's MacDonald. His is a little more like, I don't like to use the word pastoral because I think that's, I don't think the pastoral is actually devoid of logic or dogmatic logic. And I don't like that juxtaposition, but it's something more like evangelical almost. It's like a little more, it's in a direct appeal to sort of the God you've met in the gospel and in Christ existentially.
Mm-hmm. So would you say, of course, I know the answer to this question because I have read your article, but also just even in your description right there, I can maybe kind of infer what, you know, which one you lean towards, but maybe our listeners, where kind of would you find yourself on if you had to draw a spectrum between kind of Balthazar's view and McDonald's view?
So I think, the quick answer is I'm much more on McDonald's side. And the view he takes is basically the one I do. It's the conclusion I do. The caveat I would add though is this, and I think a lot of like fans of McDonald fall into this problem, and some of his own rhetoric and certain of his sermons lends to this conclusion, but I actually don't think it's even fair to him, but I'll just say what it is. Some people basically look at McDonald as like a devotional writer. And they're like, you know, he doesn't care about all that theological mumbo jumbo. He's not into the philosophical niceties or metaphysical niceties of, you know. And so what I love about McDonald's is he's just like a preacher. This guy is just talking about, you know, real life and all that. He's not being scholastic or whatever. Whereas Balthazar, I mean, yeah, he's got the whole, you know, he's the whole package as well. He can do the more, you know, homiletic sort of style, and he can do the more, you know, he can do perorations and stuff, but he can also, you know, do the scholastic metaphysics and all the other stuff as well. And so, and it's funny because in a certain way, I would kind of say, I think that the insights and the fundamental themes in McDonald, whether or not you think he himself, I think he's actually a really good theologian if you're very careful with the way you read him, and he's like logically precise. But even if he weren't, I think that the themes that he foregrounds are ones that need to be systematized and incorporated into dogmatic and systematic theology. So I am one who kind of wants both in different ways. I want McDonald's conclusions and even some of his reasonings and arguments, but I don't think that therefore closes him off to a more systematic articulation in dogmatics in a dogmatic theological, like sort of systematic way. I don't adhere to a closed system, so I'm not a systematician in that sense, but I think few are, to be honest. So I think, for example, that love isn't illogical. It's not something you do after. It's not the head-heart division where it's like, well, you know, once you think through really hard things, you just got to kind of turn to the heart. It's like, no, I mean, the heart, love is the perfection of logos. Mm-hmm. And of logic, therefore love is logical. And so these things there is no absolute separation between the two. So I do my approach, and I don't say it's the only one by far. My approach is to let's not shy away from the actual. And I have to say this, let's not shy away from the actual dogmatics and the systematics. And sometimes I think even so-called like progressive Catholics in America have seeded the ground too quickly. Mm-hmm. They've run away to other things and only do other disciplines. And I think we should be interdisciplinary. We should incorporate all that stuff and pay attention to the sciences and social sciences and natural sciences and everything in history. Of course. I mean, most of my time is doing that. But you don't need to be like, you know, the traditionalists or the, you know, those that are sort of the self-appointed champions of the tradition are the ones who do that sort of snobbish dogmatic stuff. We're going to be the more warm, heartfelt, you know, existential, like among the people. And it's like, that's just a false dichotomy. Mm. I'm definitely on McDonald's side at the end of the day, but I think additional, even proper, so-called properly theological arguments can be adduced to support it as well. I don't think it's merely like just his exegesis of a parable or something.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Time traveling just a few years, a few hundred years. let's turn to the Church Fathers. You're obviously a scholar of Maximus the Confessor. You've written a monograph on Maximus, and you're you know, working on a translation project of his letters. So you're very steeped in the world of Maximus, but also just more broadly, like you said, kind of in the Church Fathers more generally. So you've worked on people like Origen and Gregory of Nyssa, Isaac of Nineveh. So I'm wondering maybe what precedent do we have for a universalist view within some of those early thinkers of the church?
Yeah, I think in general, I would say that's another thing about the universalist discussion, of course, is that it's like there are a lot of pressing issues today that in some ways are unprecedented, and they're the hot button issues. And, people go back and forth about that. And that gets at the issue below the issue. The issue below the issue is about development and all that in a kind of certain intensity. But one thing about the universalism question is that you can't say is that it's unprecedented. And so I would say, let's just skip over the New Testament. I don't want to be too presumptuous and be like, well, the New Testament basically teaches it. So although I do think good cases can be made, actually better cases than people imagine. But, certainly in the second century, the second century pre-Nicaea, there's quite a lot of different views around. There's a second century writer who seems to rather explicitly hold to annihilationism. But I would say someone like Clement of Alexandria holds to a universalist sort of view. And some people by the way, people are going to dispute almost everyone all the time. Yeah. People will go to his descriptions of hell and so forth. But again, they never go to his discussions of divine judgment and even hell as pedagogical and as reforming, as purgative. So Clement of Alexandria is there. Origen, I think, is indisputable. He's second, third century. Then you have a whole, if you're reading some scholar like Ilaria Ramelli, she's going to make a hard pitch for a lot of different people. And some people like Athanasius of Alexandria, I know, is thrown in there. I think some of those are a little more questionable, to be honest. But nevertheless, I can understand. Sometimes what somebody should just say is there are universalist elements in someone's thought. Rather than simply coming in and making the harder pitch that this person was self-consciously a universalist. So I think someone like Athanasius, in my own opinion, is more like that, but I couldn't be persuaded otherwise. But some indisputable ones on my opinion, Evagrius Ponticus. Later he's going to get a bad rap, of course, but he's also one of the most important writers in the ascetic tradition, in the Eastern Christian tradition. Then you've got, I still do think, and by the way, I should cite Brian Daly, the great patrologist, in his recent translation of seven treatises of Gregory of Nyssa and Popular Patristics SVS series. I think it's called On Death and Eternal Life or something like that, but it's basically seven different writings. He's very clear. There's been some trends by some scholars to deny that St. Gregory of Nyssa was a universalist. Daly doesn't buy it, and I don't either. I think Gregory of Nyssa is an indisputable case of a universalist. That's third century. He's at the Constantinople one, 381. He's a massively important figure, Cappadocian father. Some people will say St. Gregory of Nazianzus. I think that's a little bit better case than St. Basil the Great, I think, is less a compelling case. But nevertheless, again, elements, they're all influenced by Origen and so on. You go on further, indisputable, St. Isaac of Nineveh, like you mentioned, one of the most important Syriac saints in all of Christian history. Kind of a little bit embarrassing, because some of his most explicit, what I call universalist writings, the second part of his great work, it's just called the second part, his ascetical homilies, very explicitly universalist, weren't discovered until mid-20th century. At least for the West and translated to the West. And so there was a little bit of St. Isaac was this beloved, saint, so if you said something he seems to hint at universalism, it's like, well, surely not so great and holy of a man as St. Isaac of Nineveh would hold to such a heretical view. But then we discover these other writings, and it's really another indisputable case. So those are some of there are other ones too. Theodore of Mopsuestia, who again, he fell on, his legacy fell on hard times for very different reasons, not having to do with this, but he was a universalist. And so there's several other more minor figures, but those are some of the big ones. And of course you'll notice in that list that there aren't a lot of Latins there. There's not a lot of Western that's certainly almost entirely to do with the influence of St. Augustine, who definitely was not a universalist, although people have made the case early on. He was open to it, and he himself never condemned universalism. He knew of it. He never condemned it as like an explicit Christian heresy, but he definitely wasn't one. So I think that more or less. But St. Ambrose of Milan, that's someone who was influential on Augustine, knew the Greeks of the time and prior, the Greek tradition, better than Augustine did. Seems to have leaned towards that at least sometimes. St. Jerome, at certain points of his life before he really went anti-Origen, he seemed to be much more open to it at the very least. So anyway, there's a lot of that. So you've got the whole continuum between indisputable cases like Gregory of Nyssa, Evagrius, St. Isaac of Nineveh, to ones that are more universalist leaning, but maybe less clear, to all the way, obviously, those who are opposed. I don't think that, I don't think it's fair to say universalism was the majority view.
Yeah.
Like in some kind of blanket statement at any point in the patristic era. I think certain areas sound like that it was more prevalent and maybe even the majority view. There's remarks that St. Basil makes, some remarks that Augustine makes that seem to suggest that certain parts of or certain areas, like local traditions and stuff, that were more universalist. Would make sense. We've got even, the Church of the East today, or the Assyrian Church, it's that tradition is predominantly universalist. So it can be locally bound, in other words. So that's kind of the rough summary of the early church.
Sure, view. Sure. Yeah, no, thank you very much. Yeah, continuing kind of with the Latin side of things that you were bringing up. So in some of your kind of internet conversations on universalism, you've talked about this book by Michel Corbin, his book on Augustine and Anselm, which I think is in French, and I'm not sure if it's been, you would know this, but I'm not sure if it's been translated into English yet. But, as you're very aware, a lot of the blame for like certain of the Latin Church's theological developments is kind of laid at the feet of Augustine. Like you see this a lot in contemporary theology. So would you say that Augustine's theology is in any way kind of antagonistic to universalist position? And maybe you've touched on this already a bit, but also though, what about kind of the way that Anselm takes up some of Augustine's terms and then kind of moves beyond them? What would you say as far as Augustine and Anselm on this question?
Yeah. Michel Corbin, he's a Jesuit, a French Jesuit. I think he's still alive today. If he is, he's getting up there, but, I think he was a teacher, by the way, of like Bishop Robert Barron at one time. But Corbin is a great, he's really great Anselm scholar, but he's written on a whole host of different figures, patristic and medieval. His thesis in that book that you're mentioning, I think it's called La Grâce de la Liberté, The Grace of Freedom, Augustine and Anselm. And it's not been translated into English. Once I was asked, if I'd be interested in doing that. And I said, yes, but I have never heard back. So I'd be happy to do it. It's a sizable book, but I'd be happy to do it because it's a really great book. I reviewed it about a decade ago. And so his thesis there is in some ways not, I don't think, that controversial. He focuses on Augustine's later bouts with Pelagianism. And of course, one of the things he says, again, this I don't think is controversial, and it's pretty common, is that Augustine and his sort of, in the sort of the heat of polemics, kind of loses what Corbin called a view of the summa concordia between the highest concord or peace between human freedom and divine grace, which even Augustine himself had once upon a time held more to, and it's more like an Eastern view or a view even you would find maybe in like St. Cassian, John Cassian. I don't know. I think by 386, 387, Augustine's pretty much not that though. I mean, If you read Ad Sulpicianum, he's very clear in his exegesis of Jacob and Esau, for example, that it is God all the way down. You know, it's not like Esau for Augustine. It's not like Esau, like God first saw him wicked and then decided not to elect him, because that would make God's, predestination, his eternal predestination, somehow contingent upon something external to himself, which would be Esau's wickedness. And so Augustine's very clear there. And it's really interesting to see that Augustine from mid 390s, all the way until the end, the City of God, the more famous books where he's very clearly eternal conscious torment. One like theme in his thought is this symmetry. I would call it something like this sort of I wouldn't want to call it a false symmetry, but it's one that really is overriding. His worry is always what we say about the wicked and their ultimate destination immediately refracts or reflects upon what we're going to say about those that are saved. So if Esau affects God's decision, as it were, in his eternal predestination of Esau, or whether or not Esau is going to be, saved, God's grace is going to be given. It's going to be made efficient for Esau. If we say that Esau himself is kind of the determinant factor in whether or not God gives the grace that's salvific to him, then you have to say the same thing about Jacob, who was good and who was sort of held up as sort of like the saved one par excellence. But then if you say that about Jacob, you're Pelagian. Now, I mean, he didn't say Pelagian at the time, because Pelagian actually, that's what's so interesting, is the country is not even in sight yet. Yeah. But he's already saying this stuff. He's already worrying about, well, if you say the damned are damned because of themselves, and God sort of, as it were, reacts to that, then we're saying the same of those who are saved, which means you save yourself through works. Because God looks at your works, whether they're good or evil, and responds to it appropriately, accordingly, right? Are you saved or are you damned? So he's going to reject that sort of, on that basis of that sort of symmetrical logic, and he's going to say, no, it's just that God actually, it's God all the way down. Of course, it's going to become controversial, and it's a legacy that I think even to this day is more or less unresolved in the Western tradition in particular, and really not fully glimpsed in the Eastern. I think there are real problems there, actually. Like, I don't actually think it's a virtue that necessarily that the East hasn't gone through a Pelagian controversy. Some people hold that up as like a good thing, like it's a sort of undisturbed. Well, no, I mean, if there are legitimate issues and tensions here in the Christian faith that Augustine brought out, we need to face them. So I actually, in that way, I welcome his legacy. So Corbin sees that, he makes that kind of diagnosis. And by the way, the symmetry that goes all the way through the City of God is that later Augustine is going to say something about, like, you know, the, when he's talking about Matthew 25, for example, he's like, the eternity that is said to be the eternal punishment needs to be symmetrically just the same quality or type of eternity as those that are saved. And if the damned, who are eternally punishment, can somehow also later end up being saved, then symmetrically again, those that are saved might also end up falling and being damned. So no, it's the eternity is the same on both sides. So against that kind of what you say here reflects on what you say there. So he's still doing that pretty much for 30 years, the last 30 years of his life. Now, what Corbin ends up saying, this book, I think, is like 2012 or something, 2013. He says that his argument is that Anselm basically from within Augustine's system returns to that Summa Concordia, and that he resists any kind of a priori rival between divine grace and human freedom. And that he sees the very conjunction of the two as the mystery. That's why it's the grace of freedom, is that freedom itself is engraced, such that the perfection of freedom is in grace itself, in the giving of grace and the receiving of grace. It makes you more free. And so it's like this paradoxical, marvelous exchange between the two. It's a summa concordia. And he thinks Anselm gets all the way. Now, so there's a lot of, and actually several different people have appealed to Anselm. By the way, also, Corbin has a different book called Espérer pour tous, to hope for all. And it's just essays on Anselm. And he ends again with the last essay as a universalist. He ends the book on Augustine and Anselm with a really lengthy exegesis of Romans 9 through 11, informed by some modern biblical scholarship, as well as an Anselmian sort of development of Augustine's thought. And he ends in a universalist read of Romans 11. That's a kind of one example of a fairly, I don't think so prominent figure in English speaking Catholic world. In fact, the only person I've ever really seen invoke Corbin is to criticize him for being like a liberal or something. And so I don't think Corbin is very well known, except maybe to Anselm scholars. But yeah, that's kind of his take. And so I think that's good. I'm not entirely sure Corbin totally gets us. I think he's clear that Anselm's, that was his project. I think that's right. I think that that's his intuition, and that's right. Anselm himself, of course, wasn't a universalist, but several have appealed to him for having like a universalist logic that flows from his thought. And so, yeah, so I don't know exactly what else to say about that, except that I think later controversies like the De Auxilis controversy, in a way, the Reformation itself and the Counter-Reformation, these things are kind of almost predictable and inevitable results of this still unresolved sense that God in the world, like who is the determinant factor in the world's resolution? Is it God, or is it his creature? Even if that creature is in his deception, chooses his own self-damnation. Now, whereas I think like the Council of Trent and a lot of theologians, especially on, say, the Dominican side, after that, in the Counter-Reformation, were very much more insistent on the Augustine view, the late Augustine, mid-late Augustine view, that no, God has to be the one who's ultimately responsible for how all this turns out, or else God is fundamentally dependent for the execution of his own will on something external to him. But God shouldn't be dependent on anything. That's what it means to be God. So that's their line. I think it's really faithful to Augustine's intuition. However, I think today we're in a moment, not just in the Catholic Church, but broadly in Christian, a lot of different Christian churches and theologians, who are far more comfortable with appealing to, say, free will as the reason, you know, a C.S. Lewis type move.
Yeah.
And actually, even in the current catechism of the Catholic Church, it's more or less the same view, which is like, no, God is, and it's actually exactly on, it follows as a consequence of God does not predestine anyone to hell. It says in the catechism, we choose this state ourselves. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of appeal to free will. Again, though, the problem then is that then the Augustinian objection reemerges, which is, well, hold on a second. Are we saying that in the end, creatures can force God to settle with a resolution that he himself never willed? Like, God has to accept as almost something external to him the self-deluded state or condition called hell that we have brought upon ourselves. And he just has to rest content with that because why? Some people will appeal to mystery vaguely. Other people will appeal to some good generic order that somehow this might fit into. Other people might just say, with C.S. Lewis, oh, no, God loses. And that's actually a sign of his omnipotence, is that he can allow himself to lose. And apparently that's supposed to be deep, but to me it just sounds absurd. So, but actually I think that's more people today find that intuitively appealing. But it's a really remarkable rejection of Augustine, some of his most fundamental intuitions. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting tension that's arisen even around this discussion of universalism. Yeah, I don't know if that gets at anything you were, but Corbin is a figure that I think has more or less been left out, but he's at least locating that this is where all this stuff, this is where a lot of the action has happened in the pre-modern era. Sure. And it's just very interesting to see that after he evaluates all that, he himself ends up in what I would want to call almost like a hard universal, a very certain, confident universalism.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, I definitely think that gets at what I was trying to ask you about. I want to time travel again many hundred years forward to the present age and talk about David Bentley Hart, because it's actually a little bit shocking how little he's come up in our Universalism Booth episodes so far, because he's kind of, I think for so many people, he's like the face of this kind of revival of Christian universalism going on today. So, such that like anybody who has kind of a beginning awareness of some of the conversations going on, that's who they tend to think of, I think, is DBH. And you have engaged with him a bit and you wrote a review on his book on the topic. So I want to ask you, maybe what do you most appreciate about his view, as he lays it out in that book, But also, are there any ways in which kind of your own view diverges from his?
Yeah, I mean, David, I don't think anyone will be surprised to say, like, David and I agree on a lot of things. And I think we have a lot of similar intuitions. And I think I have learned a lot from him. I mean, he is magnitudes of, of order smarter than I will ever be, more well-read and well-versed. I've learned from him. I've read almost everything he's written as he's written it. One of my favorite books when I was already, over a decade ago, or more than that now, I guess. Geesh, that's crazy. It's almost like 20 years ago. Was Beauty of the Infinite. And so that was like a huge part of my formation and kind of, so I've always felt a kind of resonance with David. I've learned a lot from him. I've looked to him as a kind of guide, especially on some of these matters of late. Now, I think I do want to say, I don't know if this is, but it's interesting though, because in Beauty of the Infinite, he isn't so confident at all about universalism. Hmm. And I don't know exactly how that squares with some of the things he says later, but he specifically says in Beauty of the Infinite that he wouldn't, like, when he's talking about Gregory of Nyssa's and kind of his view of the totus Christus, which I to this day agree is even in a lot of ways superior to Augustine's. He says he of Gregory's universalism, his view of apokatastasis, that Orthodox dogmatic teaching would not permit him to go that far. So I don't think it's necessarily surprising that it wasn't really until David's 2015 address at Notre Dame, about which became Meditation One of his book about ex nihilo and kind of universalism, that I do think that was a bombshell. I think that was a sort of, and I know people personally that like that talk for them specifically before it was even the book was kind of like a major turning point. So, yeah. And I thought it was excellent. I loved it. By then I was already more or less convinced by Origen and some other people of universalism. But I also, very much was welcoming of that address. And so and everything he's, more or less everything he's written about it since then. So I got a lot of appreciation for David. Of course, we have our disagreements about many different things, but in a lot of ways we have a lot more agreements, and I've never really claimed to be on his level. So I don't, I'm not necessarily trying to usurp anything, but nevertheless, I think two of the things like that are interesting to me about David's book, which I didn't include in the review because the review was that I wrote was more specifically directed towards those who dismiss the book because of its rhetoric. There was a lot of that going on, still does. And so I get it. I don't know. Some people just can't stomach certain sorts of polemical register as well as others. Okay, so but what I was trying to do partly, and I don't really think this should be that contrary. I think it's because David's rhetoric is so often like turned up to 11 that like sometimes he gets as enraged about universalism as he does about a New Testament Greek variant in the manuscript or something. But so sometimes it's hard to parse out what's the proportionate level, but I have to say, and I would still stand by that review. One thing is that David's own argument there would imply that, that nobody's like personally to blame or can't be simply morally written off for not being universalist, because part of his fundamental claim is that in a certain way we all really are. Like it's a part of almost the natural desire for God. Yeah. But the other point I wanted to just say was this doctrine of hell, which as I mentioned in my youth, has sort of overshadowed everything, it cast a shadow on everything, and other people have far more traumatic experience with it. And David opens the book with this. It's not like just some. Sometimes people treat it like whether or not you think, did Jesus know quantum physics or something, and like you start arguing about that sort of thing. And it's like, no, I mean, like for so many people, this isn't just some kind of position or game you're playing in the subset of the theology of the discipline called theology, called eschatology, and you just pick a vantage or a view and you're arguing in a debate. For so many people, their encounter with heaven or with hell and with this picture is so fundamentally personal and so entirely psychologically engrossing that the stakes are immediately high, just inherent. And so the rhetoric, I think, does sometimes, it needs to match it, you know, it needs to match the gravity. Okay. Having said that, where I do two ways, I think I would diverge or want to emphasize things differently or accent things differently than David tends to do. One is that I think in the book, Christology was a little bit more of an afterthought. It came across. It was like you appeal to Christ's two natures to show that, you know, the natural human will isn't simply a libertarian human will. And so the free will defense of hell, you know, doesn't make sense. It's irrational and incoherent. I think that really should be more the center of one's reasoning towards a universalism. It should be that not just that Christ had a natural human will and therefore couldn't sin, but that Christ knows how to bring gnomic wills to become natural wills. And this is usually where people really are kind of like focusing, because the easy response to David's like very syllogistic arguments, formal arguments for why, you know, universalism is true is stuff like, well, look, we sin every day and we know what's right and we choose what's wrong. Anyway, so I think there's the Christological sort of, I think, should be more in the foreground. But I think probably more important in terms of a divergence is that I do think sometimes David's argument, what I think is this, David's arguments are formally correct. Mm-hmm. And I agree with them. And I do think in terms of a sort of formal syllogistic chain of thought that the conclusions are more or less that they're unavoidable. The problem is no syllogism captures life. And that's fundamentally what I think what makes people hesitate. Well, there's of course the weight of the tradition and all that stuff. So there's people that will appeal to that and they feel that. And I think that's genuine. Like people are really wondering why it is that this hasn't been so as front and center for so long, if it's so important. But the other thing is that I think it just seems to be that this existence that we live in is so already fundamentally absurd that even the most cogent argument doesn't guarantee the actual resolution in the same way that the resolution itself is guaranteed by the premises.
Yeah.
And so what I want to do is emphasize more, and here in a certain way, I'm almost more Augustinian again, because on the one hand, I actually do happen to agree with Augustine that if we can effect something that is fundamentally contradictory to God's eternal predestinating will, then that puts God in a weird bind and then makes him seem more like a mythic character. But then I also think Augustine, like in his tractates on 1 John, he's very clear that love, if love is the way that your soul and your will is turned back from its incurvature into itself towards God, that is not a violation of your will.
Yeah.
And he'll appeal to like Saul of Tarsus's conversion, for example. And that's more of like a stark example. It doesn't have to be, though, some like, you know, knock you off the sort of donkey moment. It could it could be more like Augustine, like when he's reflecting on his own life, this slow kind of God providence is always working to lead me through the process. And so I guess what I'm saying is I would want to emphasize more the existential process. I want to emphasize the workings of grace that actually creates a life rather than, and that the life itself is the resolution rather than sort of a formal argument, though I don't think formal arguments are therefore, unhelpful or unclarifying. I think they're essential and important. It's just that you have to see that when you're talking about the salvation of actual persons, the guarantee has to come more on the level of the person.
Yeah.
It's not like you're proving a mathematical theorem here. It's you're trying to ask whether or not my kid who has turned away from God and who has wandered into this or that lifestyle is ever going to be restored. Really what you're asking is, can the dead be resurrected?
Mm-hmm.
There's no syllogism that establishes that, at least, or I should say that establishes how that could be so, but it's the how that can be so that is the whole question.
Yeah.
And this is where, as a Catholic, I would even put the emphasis. So, for example, in the Catechism, I was just reading this over this again today. It says specifically of the resurrection that the how, the mechanism for the resurrection, is not clear, but that it will be so is clear. And that we have a foretaste in the Eucharist for how this might be, because it's the transfiguration of our bodies, you know, into the body of Christ.
Yeah.
Okay, well, why wouldn't we be able to say the same thing about eschatology and about the salvation of all? I don't know how it will exactly happen, but I can know that it will happen, and I have a foretaste of it, actually, lo and behold, right there in the same Eucharist. Mm-hmm. The body given up for us. So anyway, I'm not against abstract arguments. I'm not against formal apodictic syllogisms or anything like that. I think those are all good and they have their place. It's just that you have to see that that won't actually be what ultimately persuades people, not because it's not cogent, but because cogency is not proven adequate to account for the process.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And if we're talking about salvation, then, you're talking about the process, quote unquote, of the dead rising to life, even if that's spiritually, and that's just simply more complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's really, really well said. And yeah, no, I appreciate your thoughtful answer on that. I want to respect your time. I know you got to get back to your girls and I got to get back to mine as well. So I just want to give you an opportunity if you want to share about any kind of works you have in progress, anything you'd like to plug here.
Sure. Yeah, thanks. Well, I have other things. I've got a few translation projects. One is the translating Maximus's letters for the Fathers of the Church series. I think that'll be coming out next year, like 2025. It seems like we're on track for that. Also part of a team translating some Schelling, but that'll probably be another year or so. No. And in terms of relevant to this conversation, probably the only thing I've already mentioned is that I hope in a few years to have, we're already working on a colleague and I are working on a book specifically on Catholic universalism. Cause I do think, and I'm glad you've included this in the booth, but I do think that perspective is more or less, I mean, it's like Balthazar is basically it for what people think of. I get emails all the time about resources for Catholic universalism, and I don't think there's much out there. And so hopefully we'll be filling that void, but that's to come as a little ways off.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I'll be looking forward to all of those for sure. Where can our listeners kind of find you online or learn more about your work?
Well, probably the place to go now would be, I have a Substack. I finally became one of those guys. So, you know, I thought, well, I'm a dad. I may as well go ahead and follow the other trends too and start a Substack. So what's it called? It's called Words in Flesh. So anyway, if you just Google that, Jordan Daniel Wood Substack, it'll come up, Words in Flesh. I basically only get out one thing every few weeks. I'm not super, I'm not like some people, and I just don't have the time right now to put into it to where I can get something out weekly. But yeah, anyway, so you can check that out. That's an easy way.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Jordan. It's been really rich and like really wide ranging conversations. I appreciate you taking the time and making time in the midst of all your dad responsibilities. Appreciate it a lot.
It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for having me back.